You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
31 of Africa's 53 countries suffered from civil disturbances in the 1990s. A side result of that is that many of the thousands of deaths resulted not from bullets, but from poverty, hunger, and disease. And on top of that, the AIDS epidemic created more than 13 million orphans. No wonder, then, that the images coming out of Africa in recent years have been largely about human suffering. But there is another largely overlooked African story, an Africa that's on the move, and that's the focus of Richard Dowden's new book from Public Affairs called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. I'm pleased that it brings Richard Dowden, the director of the Royal African Society, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Didn't you first move to Uganda in 1971 when Idi Amin was in power?
Yes, my first experience of Africa were the first 2 years of Idi Amin in Uganda.
And what drew you there?
I just wanted to see the world, I think. I had just left university and I wanted to go out and do things. I was very, very idealistic and I wanted to go and be somewhere and feel it. I think I've been reading too much Tolstoy, and I wanted to go and actually feel what it's like to be in a completely different culture.
Although you could have gone to many African countries, some a lot more stable than Uganda under Idi Amin.
Well, he'd only just come to power, and he was a hero to start with. He was thought to be very pro-Western, and he suddenly flipped about 6 months into his presidency. And Uganda went downhill pretty rapidly after that.
How long did you stay in Uganda?
2 years. I left finally when he had declared that all the foreigners in that area were spies and they had their uniforms and guns with them and they were going to arrest them all, and I thought, time to leave.
You had been a student teacher. When did you make the switch to journalist?
I came back to Britain and with 50 pence. I mean, what's that? It's a dollar in my pocket. That's all I had. And I was working the next morning packing records. And it was a pretty miserable time because I really loved Africa. And then I got a job which was as working on peace work in Northern Ireland. And I spent some time there. And then I then started to write about it and turned into a journalist. And of course, once I actually got a real journalistic job, I said, hey, can I go to Africa? It's that's where I want to go.
And in your book, you cover Somalia, Zimbabwe, Sudan, Angola, the Congo, Rwanda, Nigeria. How did you decide on them?
Well, as I was a journalist for the Times and then the Independent, when it started in 1986, the Africa editor, and then the Economist invited me to come and be their Africa editor in 1995. So this is the problem with the book is that it, if you're a journalist, you go to bad places at bad times and you witness bad things.
And you could just as easily have gone to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea-Bissau, also troubled places. I could probably name four or five others.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was in Liberia and Sierra Leone when it was bad things, and I had this growing feeling as I started to write the book that all the stories were of disaster and death, and yet what I was feeling was, but I don't remember it like that. Actually, I felt a place of, even in the worst of times, people getting by, people surviving.
So you made a vow to yourself never to describe any African nation as chaotic in your journalism. But there is a lot of chaos. Maybe you were seeing people get by, but, I mean, how can you describe Somalia or Congo, where more people have died than in any conflict since World War II? Nigeria, Zimbabwe under Mugabe, is that not chaotic?
Well, it looks chaotic to the outsider, but what I think our little group of journalists who made this vow not to ban the word chaos, our idea was that it's explicable, and it's explicable in terms that any human being can understand why we've got to where we've got here. We've seen it all in other places. This is not unique to Africa, and this idea is Africa is somehow so mysterious you can't explain it. Is nonsense.
But this is not unique to journalism. Whenever I'm in Europe and I'm reading about the United States, I think, have they gone mad? And then I come back home and life is the same as it always was. Because you're only reading about the worst things. One might assume from your choices that this book would make for grim reading, but that's not the point. In fact, you make the case that while there are a number of atrocities that have taken place in these countries, there's another side of the story that doesn't get told. And is that the fault of journalists?
Well, it's the fault of journalism. I mean, journalism, you're not going to go to Switzerland and write a piece saying another quiet day in Switzerland. No, you're not going to do that.
Actually, we're going to talk about Switzerland and the problems with UBS.
The country that I like to pick on is Yugoslavia, because we all know about Bosnia, Kosovo, Serbia. But who remembers Slovenia? That little bit of in the north of Yugoslavia escaped, declared itself independent, neat little country doing extremely well. We know nothing about it. That's the fault of journalism.
And you suggest that there's actually, and this sounds a little cynical, that it's actually a prospering relationship between the aid agencies and journalists. The journalists tell the worst stories, and then the aid money pours in.
That's right. The aid industry is – I'm not totally cynical about aid, but I'm skeptical about it. But what
are you talking about all of them, Doctors Without Borders?
No, but they do – you know, their income comes from disasters. And I know someone who worked for one of the big aid agencies, and they said our slogan should be working for our own abolition. And they got fired the next week. They couldn't get that because it is an industry. And they do work closely with journalists. Hey, there's this disaster breaking. Will you come? We'll provide you with – everything, you know, your flights, your interpreters, your explanation of what's going on. And in return, the journalist gives a little plug to the aid agency. And it's a relationship which can be very productive, but I've seen it go very, very, very rotten, with terrible exaggerations being made and really inaccurate reporting as a result.
And where are the exaggerations being made?
The worst one I saw was Goma in eastern Congo straight after the Rwandan genocide, where about 1 million people decamped across the border from Rwanda into Congo. And the aid agencies were actually competing at the daily news conference for the highest figure of deaths, a terrible outbreak of cholera there. And one would say it was, you know, 53 dead yesterday, and then somebody else say it was 67, knowing that the highest one would get on the 9 o'clock news and would get the money, because that would be their logo.
But people were dying.
People were dying, and it was a catastrophe. Except that the real catastrophe, of course, was still happening next door in Rwanda itself. And very little aid was going in there. But this is where the cameras were, and that's, as far as the world knew, was where the disaster was.
But what happened in Rwanda was largely tribal conflict, and yet you say that that's something else that's been overstated by the Western press.
Well, not overstated. What I'd say wasn't essentially tribal. I mean, it's an extraordinary relationship.
Was it the Hutus and the Tutsis?
The Hutus and Tutsis speak the same language, worship the same gods, are part of the same society. So technically, they're ethnically the same people. They're actually physically different, a physical difference that was exaggerated by colonialism, and the colonialists played one off against the other. But it's not technically tribal, and that was horrific, and that's the one place I went there right when it was happening, and I practically walked away without writing anything. I just couldn't find the words.
The same sort of thing happened in coverage of Yugoslavia as it was disintegrating. It was described as some kind of tribal conflict. And tribal conflict is often cited as a major reason for problems wherever there are tribal differences. We could say the same thing about Myanmar, Burma, for example.
I don't like the word tribe, and I've kept it because it is often exclusively applied to Africa.
So I can't say tribe, and I can't say chaos.
Well, you can. Yeah, no, you can. You can. I just said slightly tongue in cheek. You know, I would say to the editor, I'll use the word tribe in Africa when you use it to describe that land conflict between two Semitic tribes down the far end of the Mediterranean. When that's described as tribal, I'll use it in Africa. It would always get a laugh, but I think I made the point. We all have tribes.
Richard Dowden's book, Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles, is published by Public Affairs, and on the cover is a picture of a little boy holding a soccer ball. Obviously not a troubled child. He looks like he's not suffering from malnutrition, which I guess is one of your points.
The publisher showed me that picture. I said, I don't want a half-naked African child. That's not what my book's about. And then they said, well, find a better one. And then I looked at him, and he's not the happy, smiling African kid. He's not begging. He's looking very strong, very much himself. And then I thought, well, actually, you know, who is he? And I managed to actually find him in Ghana. It wasn't just a casual picture taken by a photographer, but I tracked him down. And he's doing okay. He's in school and got a request for a new set of football shirts for his team last week.
And where is he?
In Ghana. He's just out. Mm. He lives in a suburb of Accra, the capital of Ghana.
Well, Ghana is one of the countries that seems to have an optimistic outlook at the moment. It's had its troubles in the past. And some countries have righted themselves. But then you look at a country like Sudan. Is there anything positive to say about Sudan?
The big question is, will it hold together? I think
and should it hold together?
And should it hold
together?
It's
a huge country.
It's a huge country, another one just created by an imperial power, in this case the Ottomans rather than the British took it over. I would say yes, in lots of ways it could come right, but the core ruling group, which is all from one area, has to open up the country to real democracy, and it has to probably become a federation or something like that. I mean, the south is going to split anyway, and I think the other parts will then say, hey, we want a share of the cake as well.
Do you believe that the International Criminal Court made the right decision when it indicted Omar al-Bashir?
I think it was right to have a file on him, to pursue him, to threaten, to expose what he was doing, to say we're coming to get you, but to actually do it, no. I think it was a huge mistake to indict a sitting head of state, which you have no prospect of arresting, none whatever, in the foreseeable future.
You've spent a fair amount of time in Sudan, haven't you?
Yes, yeah.
In fact, you had a 16-year-old soldier die in your arms.
Well, holding my hand, yes, flying back from a battle in the south back into Kenya, and he... he was a lovely kid, and I was frightened. I mean, I was really worried, and he just looked at me very reassuringly, and then I turned around. When I turned back, he was gone. Yeah,
it was. Well, a peace settlement was affected in Sudan because of one rebellion, but Darfur seems like it's insoluble.
It is very, very complicated, and it. Because it's not a straightforward rebellion against the government. It has a very strong local element, and that's
not
the local
tribal
element gets. Well, it's tribal and ethnic and racial, and it's all those mixed up. I would say at the moment it's those who've agreed to come in with the government and those who have agreed to stay out and go on fighting for more. It's the way that war is conducted, though, is so vicious, because the way you win is by driving civilians away from their livelihoods, and then they starve, and that's the way that war's been fought.
You traced tribal links and alliances across Sudan's borders with Uganda and Chad. We forget that just because there's a border doesn't mean that one group is going to be located only in a certain country.
That's right, and this
we're
is
seeing
to
the
me,
same
is,
thing in Afghanistan and Pakistan right now.
Yeah, these borders that were drawn by the Europeans, the British, the French, the Germans, and they just sat in their offices in London, Paris, Berlin, drawing lines on the map of Africa and of Afghanistan, Pakistan as well. Saying, right, this bit's your bit, this bit's our bit, this is, and without any regard for the people who lived there. I think this is the core of Africa's political problems.
Well, you've been critical of AIDS groups. What about the other people, the prominent politicians, the journalists, the activists, and all the entertainers who have suggested that the United States must get involved in Sudan?
Well, I think it's good. I think that the rest of the world should be involved, but not in a let's just solve this problem. I think you have to really understand the dynamics underneath, because all those politics are local. They're local. And unless you understand that dynamic, you can easily make it worse.
Well, many people are upset that we stood by and let 800,000 or more people be slaughtered in Rwanda. And now we're standing by and letting people die on a regular basis in Sudan. And in Congo, and perhaps in Zimbabwe in another way. And have we learned any lessons from history?
If we've learned a lesson, it should be that when you go into a place like this, you really do have to work very, very hard to understand it. and not go in a sort of patronising way, we're going to sort this out. I mean, this is my message, is not I've got the answer, but I know that the approach has to be right. And again, a diplomat, a general would be picked from somewhere because he's been successful there and then parachuted in and expected to solve this problem. And it's just the wrong way of going about things. It doesn't respect the local players. And I think the most successful peace missions in Africa have been ones where the people themselves have actually done the deal, maybe with a little bit of outside help and support and a lot of bit of arm twisting in the background, but those are the ones that have worked.
My guest is Richard Dowden, who spent a decade as Africa editor of The Independent and then another decade as Africa editor of The Economist. He's made 3 television documentaries about Africa for the BBC and Channel 4. And he has a book out called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Richard Dowden, whose book, Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles, is published by Public Affairs. Well, you mentioned that there's been some outside intervention, and some of it has involved the African Union. Should they be called in to resolve the problems? They've been very ineffective in Sudan, for example.
The leadership of Africa is still the presidents of the 53 countries. And there was hope that the African Union would become a power in its own right. But I think while it's not totally ineffective, it still depends on a couple of very heavyweight presidents giving it real support. And once Thabo Mbeki in South Africa and Olusegun Obasanjo in Nigeria stepped down, then it really lost those real heavyweight presidents who could make things happen.
But Mbeki did nothing in Zimbabwe. If anything, he really prevented any progress in that country.
I wouldn't say he did nothing, but he was unable for a whole lot of reasons to do what the West wanted him to do. Not least because he's much younger than Mugabe and would be regarded as a little boy. He just couldn't eyeball him and say, this is what you've got to do. That was the problem with Mbeki.
One of the images we get from Africa is of total suffering at the refugee camps. Are the refugee camps as bad as we keep on hearing?
A lot of them are pretty bad, particularly where it's very difficult to keep them supplied. But I've been to ones where, in fact, they are extraordinarily sort of vibrant places with sort of nightclubs and discussion groups and schools and all sorts of things going on. I mean, these would be ones that have been there for a long time, but people have really learned to live in them. And it was fascinating in northern Uganda, where they've been gathered into these villages built at the edges of towns, where the older people said, we want to go home, we want to go home. The younger people were saying, well, actually, we rather like this town life, and the idea that I'm going to go back and pick up a hoe and start digging in some village that I've never been to, I don't want to do that. I want to stay here.
Well, there are other problems. There's the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, which makes it dangerous for people to go back to some of the farms.
Yeah, but the LRA's been sort of chased out of northern Uganda now, and it's safer. But they went on living. They used to live in very separate little homesteads, but they're now all the villages they're recreating are villages all banded together because of that security issue.
In many cases, the countries where these refugee camps have been set up are not all that happy about this influx of people from neighbors. We've seen that just recently in South Africa, where they closed down a refugee camp of people who had escaped from Zimbabwe.
Well, they've had a huge influx into South Africa because of its economic power and job opportunities, which don't exist in countries like Congo, and certainly with Zimbabwe collapsing. I mean, 2-3 million people. When you look at the numbers of refugees in Africa across borders, you'd think there would be a great deal more violence against them. But there is this. Africans are very proud of the fact we do look after refugees. We know what it's like, and we welcome them. And there is remarkably little of this friction, considering the numbers.
And you're suggesting that all we hear a lot about the problems in Africa, but we don't hear about the examples of humanity.
Well, that's what I
the generosity.
This is what I found all the time, and which I maybe didn't write about at the time so much, but thinking back, those are the things that really moved me. A particular example in Burundi, where there'd been a horrific massacre of Hutus by Tutsis.
They have similar problems to what happened in Rwanda.
The Hutu-Tutsi thing, and they all live on the same hills, and suddenly there'd been this explosion of violence, and a lot of Hutus had been killed. And I went down there, and I found, there was the hillside had been devastated, all the little homes had been burnt. But I found this old Tutsi man protecting about 30 Hutus in his own house, and just his own personal authority. He'd been a policeman, he was retired, he was an old man, kept them alive. And I just thought, that's an amazingly brave man.
You tell the story of Africans who visit to London and are horrified that people don't stop and talk to their colleagues or have as much of a sense of community as they would in Africa.
That's the big one. A friend of mine who I'd known in northern Nigeria, he came to London, and I immediately sat him down after a couple of days and said, "So, what do you feel?" And he just was astounded the way people, even colleagues will come in and they won't greet each other, they won't stop and chat. He said you're not friends with each other here. We're all friends, and you do sense that warmth and friendship in Africa. The desire to sit and talk and build relationships, which I think we've lost in the business of our lives.
My guest is Richard Dowden, Dowden, who is the director of the Royal African Society. He's written a book called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There are many examples in the book of where outside aid has caused more harm than good. One case in particular in Rwanda, where you write that the refugee camps set up in the Congo in late 1994 were populated not by the victims of the genocide, but by the perpetrators, and that the genocidal army sold food to buy weapons. Now, that food was being given to them by aid groups who were totally unaware that this was going on?
It came to light, they had grossly exaggerated the numbers. And so and anybody who had a flag flying there could have made appeals for money, and they poured the food in. And the journalists, I remember doing the story myself. Close to the refugee camp was the army camp. This is the defeated army of Rwanda, and they're the people who organized the genocide, and there they all were in their own separate camp. And it was their legal status was very, very doubtful, but Mobutu, who was then ruling in Congo, or Zaire as it was called then, would do nothing about it. And what we then discovered was that the food from the camp was being sold on the local markets, and the money taken by the soldiers who were then buying arms and rebuilding their army. So it was a case of the aid agencies actually feeding the war.
And we're seeing the legacy of that even today in eastern Congo, because the war that continues is largely a carryover of the war from Rwanda.
It is. It's been displaced out of Rwanda into eastern Congo. It's upset the local power balance there.
But what would you have suggested, since you do seem to be opposed to intervention? Should we have just remained neutral, which unfortunately I think we did during the Rwandan genocide?
I think that an intervention then would definitely have saved lives. And it's fascinating now to the evidence shows that, in retrospect, that the government knew exactly what sort of intervention they could expect, and they read it absolutely right, that because of what had happened in Somalia with Black Hawk Down a few months before, that America was simply not going to intervene or back a UN intervention.
But there were further problems that the UN was split. There were countries that were supporting the Hutus in this, and very powerful countries, European countries.
Well, France was,
and
Congo, and Belgium, and the Francophone African countries, who were their protégés, were indeed supporting Habyarimana and the government, and still thought that this was the rightful government because it had been invaded by these former refugees who were now coming back trying to take over the country. So it was, there was a lot of resistance to You know, it was intervention, but to prop up the old genocidal government.
And what should have happened? Should the West have come in, or should an African force have been put together?
I think that what the West can do, if, again, they've done their homework and worked, you know, and really got a good understanding of what's happening on the ground, is to send in a fast-moving, heavy firepower force to stop the fighting, and that can be done, and then immediately pull back and allow African troops from the African Union to take over and the UN. But it does need that, sometimes it does need that initial punch, and that's often lacking.
Wouldn't a lot of the aid to Africa dry up if it were suggested that Africans should be left alone to develop their own continent?
That's the biggest question of all, and I can't. I'm sometimes tempted to say, just stop all the aid, not the little aid. You know, you and I might send money just for this school or that project or something.
Well, doctors go and help. And,
yeah, this sort of thing. That's absolutely. But the idea that a massive amount of aid given to African governments can somehow develop Africa is, I think, I think it's just wrong.
Well, many Africans have complained that it just has put them on the equivalent of the dole, and that there's no encouragement for them to go and create their own industry or create indigenous industries. And many people blame the World Bank.
Yeah, and I think probably rightly in many cases. I mean, I think that this whole idea of outsiders doing it all. No, you can build schools, you can build hospitals. Get on with it. You know, what's the problem? And of course, the biggest problem is that those African governments are accountable then to the World Bank, you know, to the British government, to the American government, and not to their own people. And until they're accountable to their own people, who will demand, we want a school or we're not voting for you next time. But at the moment, those people don't pay taxes, so they don't have a say in what their government does.
Many activists who are concerned about what's going on in Darfur have been critical of China. What do you see the Chinese role in Africa as being?
It's early days, but the biggest impact has been the commercial one. Their demand for Africa's raw materials, which incidentally China then turns into goods for us. So our demand for Chinese goods feeds China's demands for Africa's goods, and that has pushed the prices, and that's been terrific for Africa. Its income has increased hugely, and I think that accounts for a lot of the 5-6% growth rate that across Africa that we've seen the last few years. That's been really, really important. The problem is that the Chinese are not in the slightest bit concerned about human rights or democracy. If you're the government, you're the government. We deal with you. We don't ask questions. We don't lecture you. African leaders like that, they would do. But it doesn't help the democratic process in Africa at all.
Well, the Chinese feel the same way about their own situation.
They don't have any in their own country,
They don't want us to ask them about Tibet and
but
other problems.
But I think what's going to happen is that the Chinese will, like everyone else, they rush into Africa. They're welcomed with open arms. And what a lovely place, lovely people. And then Africa has ways of pushing back, and I think they are beginning to realize that by operating in Africa, you do need to know what's going on under the surface, and you need to know the sort of secret ways in which power is distributed in Africa. Otherwise, they'll come a cropper.
We have been hearing about the use of new technologies, mobile phones being made available, these mini banks being made available for people to develop their own businesses. How effective are these things?
I think the mobile phones have transformed Africa in so many ways. I mean, everybody said, you know, how do you think you can sell a mobile phone in Africa? Well, maybe the top 3 or 4% or something. No, it was at the bottom of the pyramid that the money was made from mobile phones. You will not get into a taxi in Africa without the taxi driver giving you his mobile phone number. But the most remarkable ones, which I've seen, is in the markets. I mean, market women phoning the next market, checking the prices there. And I think the most dramatic example was in Somalia, up on above the Red Sea, where the herdsmen have all their sheep and goats, and they sell them across the Red Sea to Jeddah, to Saudi Arabia. But they need to know the price there, because it's, you know, they're going to make a big loss if the price is low. So they need to know when to come down, out of the mountains to the coast and see a Somali herdsman borrowing a mobile phone to check the price across the sea in Jeddah. I thought that was just unbelievable.
The repression in some countries like Nigeria has led to a brain drain. Are we seeing a return of people who left? Are we seeing African emigres reinvesting in their old countries?
You're certainly seeing Africans investing in their own countries. I mean, I think it's something like $20 billion a year go back in remittances from workers outside. It's huge and has been growing. Whether it'll continue to grow with the general recession at the moment is doubtful. But that's one. But will they go back? It's difficult. You've got your kids in school. You've got debt. Can you really uproot yourself and go back? But many who have been successful are going back, and say, I'm going back. I've interviewed many of them, and they say the quality of life. And you say, but you were living in America or Europe. And it just shows my own prejudice that I regard that as a better quality of life. They say, no, it's much better back home in Ghana. I mean, it is.
You say some of them would prefer to live in the village.
Around the town as a professional middle classes, and they have a very, very nice quality of life there.
I'm sure Tony Blair was doing the right thing in his mind when he described Africa 4 years ago as a scar on the conscience of the world. Do you think how was that taken in Africa?
They were insulted by it. All the Africans who heard it. Yes, there would be many Africans who are in a bad way and wouldn't have heard it, but many of those who did felt insulted by that phrase. You know, we're a scar. I think it was an unfortunate phrase. I mean, there are things happening there which are bad, but to say the whole continent of Africa is like that, I think was a very impolite way of describing a beautiful continent.
Well, why haven't more countries been able to pull it together? I mean, we see those exceptions. Ghana is working things out. Liberia is working things out after terrible trauma. Botswana is often cited as the ideal. South Africa to some degree, but probably would not have done as well if Nelson Mandela hadn't been Nelson Mandela. But why can't we see more of that? Why are we more likely to see these people who come to power with idealism and wind up becoming the worst kinds of repressive dictators?
That is a very, very difficult question. As you will gather, I'm very optimistic about African people, African societies. Africa's politics are what have messed it up, and it is overcoming this deep trauma of the colonial takeover, and then which was actually quite a short takeover. And I mean, my feeling was it was short enough to destroy the political leadership, the cultural leadership of Africa, but not long enough to replace it with something else, as happened in other colonized places.
But we're talking now 40 years later.
It's still working its way through, and idealistic leaders do emerge, and then what happens? They want to stay in power, and then they have to play the ethnic card to stay in power, and that's where things go wrong. And I just think it is going to take a long time. There's going to be no quick fixes until you have, I think, that professional middle class as a group that aren't going to run away and actually do call the shots in those countries, not savior dictators and not the old elders of the tribe's way, but a professional middle class, and that is growing, and that's why I'm optimistic in the medium term about Africa.
Well, I have a similar feeling about Mexico, where I've had wonderful experiences with many Mexicans, but I also am aware of the fact that that's a troubled country, and right now it's a dangerous place to be. So we can choose to focus on the humanity of most people, or we can focus on the dangerous groups that that engage in drug trafficking or diamond trade or whatever it is that they're doing, or are kidnapping children, become child soldiers.
Well, I think that's what my book does. Is I don't pull, because I've seen the bad stuff. I mean, I was in Rwanda as the genocide was going on. I've been shot at, I think, in, or heard shots fired in anger in 20, I counted them the other day, 20 wars, and I've seen, you know, a lot of starvation, and I don't pull back on that. But I still feel that there is a spirit there that will pull through, and country by country is building something, and that it will work out, hopefully, in my lifetime, and you'll see prosperous African countries before, you know, in the medium term.
Richard Dowden has been Africa editor of The Independent and The Economist. Now he is director of the Royal African Society. And his book, Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.